Paris, France, July 29th, 1715. 4. Dreamer is too soft a word. It conjures thoughts of silken sleep, of lazy days and fields of tall grass, of charcoal smudges on soft parchment. Addie still holds on to dreams, but she is learning to be sharper. Less the artist's hand and more the knife, honing the pencil's edge. "Pour me a drink," she says, holding out the bottle of wine, and the man pries out the cork and fills two glasses from the low shelf of the rented room. He hands her one, and she doesn't touch it as he throws his back in a single swallow, downs a second before abandoning the glass and reaching for her dress. "Where's the rush?" she says, guiding him back. "You've paid for the room. We have all night." She is careful not to push him away, careful to keep the pressure of her resistance coy. Some men, she's found, take pleasure in disregarding the wishes of a woman. Instead, Addie lifts her own glass to his hungry mouth, tips the rust-red contents between his lips, tries to pass the gesture off as seduction instead of force. He drinks deep, then knocks the glass away. Clumsy hands paw at her front, fighting with the laces and the stays.
"I cannot wait to," he slurs,
but the drug in the wine is already taking hold, and soon he trails off, his tongue going heavy in his mouth. He sags back onto the bed, still grasping at her dress, and a moment later, his eyes roll back and he slumps sideways, lost to sleep before his head strikes the thin pillow. Addie leans over and pushes until he rolls off the bed, hitting the floor like a sack of grain. The man lets out a muted groan, but does not wake. She finishes his work, loosening the laces of her dress until she can breathe again. Paris fashion, twice as tight as country clothes and half as practical. She stretches out on the bed, grateful to have it to herself, at least for the night. She does not want to think about tomorrow when she is forced to start again. That is the madness of it. Every day is amber, and she is the fly trapped inside. No way to think in days or weeks when she lives in moments. Time begins to lose its meaning, and yet she has not lost track of time. She cannot seem to misplace it, no matter how she tries, and so Addie knows what month it is, what day, what night, and so she knows it has been a year. A year since she ran from her own wedding, a year since she fled into the woods, a year since she sold her soul for this, for freedom, for time. A year. And she has spent it learning the boundaries of this new life. Walking the edges of her curse like a lion in its cage. She has seen lions now. They came to Paris in the spring as part of an exhibit. They were nothing like the beasts of her imagination, so much grander and so much less, their majesty diminished by the dimensions of their cells. Addie went a dozen times to see them, studied their mournful gazes, looking past the visitors to the gap in the tent, the single sliver of freedom. A year she's spent bound within the prism of this deal, forced to suffer but not die, starve but not waste, want but not wither. Every moment pressed into her own memory while she herself slips from the minds of others with the slightest push, erased by a closing door, an instant out of sight, a moment of sleep, unable to leave a mark on anyone or anything. Even the man slumped on the floor. She draws the stoppered bottle of laudanum from her skirts and holds it to the meager light. 3 tries and 2 bottles of the precious medicine wasted before she realized she could not drug the drinks herself, could not be the hand that did the harm. But mix it in the bottle of wine, reset the cork, and let them pour their own glass, and the action is no longer hers. See? She is learning. It is a lonely education. She tips the bottle, the last of the milky substance shifting inside the glass, and wonders if it might buy her a night of dreamless sleep, a deep and drugged peace.
How disappointing.
At the sound of the voice, Addie nearly drops the laudanum. She twists around in the small room, scouring the dark, but cannot find its source.
I confess, my dear, I expected more.
The voice seems to come from every shadow, then from one. It gathers in the darkest corner of the room, like smoke, and then he steps forward into the circle cast by the candle flame. Black curls tumble across his brow, shadows land in the hollows of his face, and green eyes glitter with their own internal light. And for a traitorous instant, her heart lurches at the familiar sight of her stranger. Before she remembers, it is only him, the darkness from the woods. A year she's lived this curse, and in that time she's called for him. She's pleaded with the night, sunk coins she could not spare into the banks of the Seine, begged for him to answer just so she could ask why. Now, she throws the bottle of laudanum straight at his head. The shadow does not move to catch it, does not need to. It passes straight through, shatters against the wall behind him. He gives her a pitying smile.
Hello, Adeline.
Adeline, a name she thought she'd never hear again, a name that aches like a bruise, even as her heart skips to hear it. You, she snarls. The barest incline of his head, the curl of his smile.
Have you missed me?
She hurtles toward him like the stoppered bottle, throws herself against his front, half expecting to fall through and shatter as it did. But her hands meet flesh and bone, or at least the illusion of it. She pounds against his chest, and it is like striking a tree, just as hard and just as pointless. He looks down at her, amused.
I see you have.
She tears herself away, wants to scream, to rage, to sob. You left me there. You took everything from me and you left. Do you know how many nights I begged?
I heard you,
he says, and there is an awful pleasure in the way he says it. Addie sneers with rage. But you never came. The darkness spreads his arms as if to say, I am here now. And she wants to strike him, useless as it is, wants to banish him, cast him from this room like a curse. But she must ask. She must know. Why? Why did you do this to me? His dark brows knit with false worry, mock concern.
I granted your wish.
I asked only for more time, for a life of freedom.
I have given you both.
His fingers trail along the bedpost.
This past year has taken no toll.
A stifled sound escapes her throat, but he continues.
You are whole, are you not? And uninjured. You do not age, you do not wither. And as for freedom, is there any keener liberation than what I've gifted you? A life with no one to answer to.
You know this is not what I wanted.
You did not know what you wanted,
he says sharply, stepping toward her.
And if you did, then you should have been more careful.
You deceived!
You erred,
says the darkness, closing the last space between them.
Don't you remember, Adeline?
His voice drops to a whisper.
You were so brash, so brazen, tripping over your words as if they were roots, rambling on about all the things you did not want.
He is so close to her now, one hand drifting up her arm, and she wills herself not to give him the satisfaction of retreat, not to let him play the wolf and force her into the part of sheep. But it is hard. For all that he is painted as her stranger, he is not a man, not even human. It is only a mask, and it does not fit. She can see the thing beneath as it was in the woods, shapeless and boundless, monstrous and menacing. The darkness shimmers behind that green-eyed gaze.
You asked for an eternity and I said no. You begged and pleaded and then, do you remember what you said?
When he speaks again, his voice is still his voice, but she can hear her own echoing through it.
You can have my life when I am done with it. You can have my soul when I don't want it anymore. She draws back from the words, from him, or tries to, but this time he does not let her. The hand on her arm tightens, the other rests like a lover's touch behind her neck.
Was it not in my best interest, then, to make your life unpleasant, to press you toward your inevitable surrender?
You did not have to, she whispers, hating the waver in her voice.
My dear Adeline,
he says, hand sliding up her neck into her hair.
I am in the business of souls, not mercy.
His fingers tighten, forcing her head back, her gaze up to meet his own, and there is no sweetness in his face, only a kind of feral beauty.
Come, he says. Give me what I want, and the deal will be done, this misery ended.
A soul for a single year of grief and madness. A soul for copper coins on a Paris dock. A soul for nothing more than this. And yet, it would be a lie to say she does not waver, to say that no part of her wants to give up, give in, if only for a moment. Perhaps it is that part that asks,
what would become of me?
Those shoulders, the ones she drew so many times, the ones she conjured into being, give only a dismissive shrug.
You will be nothing, my dear, he says simply. But it is a kinder nothing than this. Surrender, and I will set you free.
If some part of her wavered, if some small part wanted to give in, it did not last beyond a moment. There is a defiance in being a dreamer. I decline, she growls. The shadow scowls, those green eyes darkening like cloth soaked wet. His hands fall away.
You will give in, he says, soon enough.
He does not step back, does not turn to go. He is simply gone, swallowed by the dark. New York City, March 13th, 2014. 5. Henry Strauss has never been a morning person. He wants to be one, has dreamed of rising with the sun, sipping his first cup of coffee while the city is still waking, the whole day ahead and full of promise. He's tried to be a morning person, and on the rare occasion he's managed to get up before dawn, it was a thrill. To watch the day begin, to feel, at least for a little while, like he was ahead instead of behind. But then a night would go long, and a day would start late, and now he feels like there's no time at all, like he is always late for something. Today, it is breakfast with his younger sister, Muriel. Henry hurries down the block, his head still ringing faintly from the night before, and he would have canceled, should have canceled. But he's canceled 3 times in the last month alone, and he doesn't want to be a shitty brother. She just wants to be a good sister, and that's nice. That's new. He's never been to this place before. It's not one of his local haunts, though the truth is, Henry's running out of coffee shops in his vicinity. Vanessa ruined the first, Milo the second, the espresso at the third tasted like charcoal, so he let Muriel pick one, and she chose a quaint little hole in the wall called Sunflower that apparently doesn't have a sign or an address or any way to find it except by some hipster radar that Henry obviously lacks. At last, he spots a single sunflower stenciled on a wall across the street. He jogs to make the light, bumping into a guy on the corner, mumbles apologies, even as the other man says, "It's fine, it's fine, it's totally fine." When Henry finally finds the entrance, the hostess is halfway through telling him there's no space, but then she looks up from the podium and smiles and says she'll make it work. Henry looks around for Muriel, but she's always considered time a flexible concept, so even though he's late, she's definitely later.
And he's secretly glad for once, because it gives him a moment to breathe, to smooth his hair and rest himself free of the scarf that's trying to strangle him, even order a coffee. He tries to make himself look presentable, even if it doesn't matter what he does, it won't change what she sees. But it still matters. It has to. 5 minutes later, Muriel sweeps in. She is, as usual, a tornado of dark curls and unshakable confidence. Muriel Strauss, who at 24 only ever talks about the world in terms of conceptual authenticity and creative truth, who's been a darling of the New York art scene since her first semester at Tisch, where she quickly realized she was better at critiquing art than creating it. Henry loves his sister, he does. But Muriel's always been like strong perfume. Better in small doses, and at a distance. "Henry!" she shouts, shedding her coat and dropping into the seat with a dramatic flourish. "You look great," she says, which isn't true, but he simply says, "You too, Muir." She beams and orders a flat white, and Henry braces for an awkward silence, because the truth is, he has no idea how to talk to her. But if Muriel's good at anything, it's holding up a conversation. So he drinks his black coffee and settles in while she rolls through the latest pop-up gallery drama, then her schedule for Passover, raves about an experiential art festival on the High Line, even though it isn't open yet. It isn't until after she finishes a rant on a piece of street art that was definitely not a pile of trash, but in fact a commentary on capitalist waste, to the echo of Henry's mms and nods, that Muriel brings up their older brother. "He's been asking about you." This is a thing Muriel has never said, not about David, never to Henry, so he cannot help himself. "Why?" His sister rolls her eyes. "I imagine it's because he cares." Henry nearly chokes on his drink. David Strauss cares about a lot of things. He cares about his status as the youngest head surgeon at Sinai. He cares, presumably, about his patients. He cares about making time for Midrash, even if it means he has to do it in the middle of a Wednesday night. He cares about his parents and how proud they are of what he's done. David Strauss does not care about his younger brother, except for the myriad ways in which he's ruining the family reputation. Henry looks down at his watch, even though it doesn't tell the time, or any time for that matter. "Sorry, sis," he says, scraping back his chair. "I've got to open the store." She cuts herself off, something she never used to do, and rises from the chair to wrap her arms around his waist, squeezing him tight. It feels like an apology, like affection, like love. Muriel is a good 5 inches shorter than Henry, enough that he could rest his chin on her head, if they were that kind of close, which they're not.
"Don't be a stranger," she says, and Henry promises he won't.
New York City, March 13th, 2014. 6. Addie wakes to someone touching her cheek. The gesture is so gentle, at first she thinks she must be dreaming. But then she opens her eyes and sees fairy lights on the roof, sees Sam crouched beside the lawn chair, a worried crease across her forehead. Her hair has been set free, a mane of wild blonde curls around her face. "Hey, Sleeping Beauty," she says, tucking a cigarette back into its box, unlit. Addie shivers and sits up, pulling the jacket tight around her. It's a cold, cloudy morning, the sky a stretch of sunless white. She didn't mean to sleep this long, this late. Not that she has anywhere to be, but it certainly seemed like a better idea last night when she could feel her fingers. The Odyssey has fallen off her lap. It lies face down on the ground, the cover slick with morning dew. She reaches to pick it up, does her best to dust the jacket off, smooth the pages where they got bent or smudged. "It's freezing out here," says Sam, pulling Addie to her feet. "Come on." Sam always talks like that, statements in place of questions, imperatives that sound like invitations. She pulls Addie toward the rooftop door, and Addie is too cold to protest, simply trails Sam down the stairs to her apartment, pretending she doesn't know the way. The door swings open onto madness. The hall, the bedroom, the kitchen are all stuffed full of art and artifact. Only the living room at the back of the apartment is spacious and bare. No sofa or tables there, nothing but two large windows, an easel, and a stool. "This is where I do my living," she said when she first brought Addie home. And Addie answered, "I can tell." She's crammed everything she owns into three quarters of the space just to preserve the peace and quiet of the fourth. Her friend offered her a studio space at an insane deal, but it felt cold, she said, and she needs warmth to paint. "Sorry," says Sam, stepping around a canvas, over a box. "It's a bit cluttered right now." Addie has never seen it any other way. She would love to see what Sam is working on, what put the white paint under her nails and led to the smudge of pink just below her jaw. But instead, Addie forces herself to follow the girl around and over and through the mess into the kitchen. Sam snaps on the coffee maker, and Addie's eyes slide over the space, marking the changes. A new purple vase, a stack of half-read books, a postcard from Italy, a collection of mugs, some sprouting clean brushes, and always growing. "You paint?" she says, nodding at the stack of canvases leaning against the stove. "I do," says Sam, a smile breaking over her face. "Abstracts, mostly. Nonsense art, my friend Jake calls it. But it's not really nonsense, it's just other people paint what they see. I paint what I feel. Maybe it's confusing, swapping one sense for another, but there's beauty in the transmutation." Sam pours two cups of coffee, one mug green, as shallow and wide as a bowl, the other tall and blue. "Cats or dogs?" she asks, instead of green or blue, even though there are no dogs or cats on either of them, and Addie says, "Cats," and Sam hands her the tall blue cup without any explanation. Their fingers brush, and they are standing closer than she realized, close enough for Addie to see the streaks of silver in the blue of Sam's eyes, close enough for Sam to count the freckles on her face. "You have stars," she says. "Déjà vu," thinks Addie again. She wills herself to pull away, to leave, to spare herself the insanity of repetition and reflection. Instead, Addie wraps her hands around the cup and takes a long sip. The first note is strong and bitter, but the second is rich and sweet. She sighs with pleasure, and Sam flashes her a brilliant grin. "Good, right?" she says. "The secret is cacao nibs," thinks Addie. "Cacao nibs," says Sam, taking a long sip from her cup, which Addie is convinced now is really a bowl. She drapes herself over the counter, head bowed over the coffee as if it were an offering. "You look like a wilted flower," teases Addie. Sam winks and lifts her cup. "Water me and watch me bloom." Addie has never seen Sam like this in the morning. Of course, she's woken up beside her, but those days were tinged with apologies, unease, the aftermath of the absence of memory. It is never fun to linger in those moments. Now, though, this is new, a memory made for the first time. Sam shakes her head. "Sorry, I never asked your name." This is one of the things she loves about Sam, one of the first things she ever noticed. Sam lives and loves with such an open heart, shares the kind of warmth most reserve only for the closest people in their lives. Reasons come second to needs. She took her in, she warmed her up before she thought to ask her name. "Madeleine," says Addie, because it is the closest she can get. "Mmm," says Sam, "my favorite kind of cookie. I'm Sam." "Hello, Sam," she says, as if tasting the name for the first time. "So," says the other girl, as if the question only just occurred to her, "what were you doing up there on the roof?" "Oh," says Addie with a small, self-deprecating laugh, "I didn't mean to fall asleep up there.
I don't even remember sitting down on the lawn chair. I must have been more tired than I thought. I just moved in, 2F, and I don't think I'm used to all the noise. I couldn't sleep. Finally gave up and went up there to get some fresh air and watch the sun rise over the city. The lie rolls out so easily, the way paved with practice. We're neighbors, says Sam. You know, she adds, setting her empty cup aside, I'd love to paint you sometime. And Addie fights the urge to say, you already have. I mean, it wouldn't look like you, Sam rambles on, heading into the hall. Addie follows, watches her stop and run her fingers over a stack of canvases, turning through them as if they were records in a vinyl shop. I've got this whole series I'm working on, she says, of people as skies. A dull pang echoes through Addie's chest, and it's 6 months ago, and they are lying in bed, Sam's fingers tracing the freckles on her cheeks, her touch as light and steady as a brush. You know, she'd said, they say people are like snowflakes, each one unique, but I think they're more like skies. Some are cloudy, some are stormy, some are clear, but no two are ever quite the same. And what kind of sky am I? Addie had asked then, and Sam had stared at her, unblinking, and then brightened, and it was the kind of brightening she had seen with 100 artists, 100 times, the glow of inspiration, as if someone switched on a light beneath their skin. And Sam, suddenly animated, wound to life, sprang from the bed, taking Addie with her into the living room. An hour of sitting on the hardwood floor, wrapped in only a blanket, listening to the murmur and scrape of Sam mixing paint, the hiss of the brush on the canvas. And when it was done, and when Addie came around to look at it, what she saw was the night sky. Not the night sky as anyone else would have painted it. Bold streaks of charcoal and black and thin slashes of middle gray, the paint so thick it rose up from the canvas, and flecked across the surface, a handful of silver dots. They looked almost accidental, like spatter from a brush, but there were exactly 7 of them, small and distant and wide apart as stars. Sam's voice draws her back to the kitchen. I wish I could show you my favorite piece, she's saying now. It was the first in a series, One Forgotten Night. I sold it to this collector on the Lower East Side. It was my first major sale, paid my rent for 3 months, got me into a gallery. Still, it's hard letting go of the art. I know I have to. That whole starving artist thing is overrated, but I miss it every day. Her voice dips softer. The crazy thing is, every one of the pieces in that series is molded after someone. Friends, people here in the building, strangers I found on the street. I remember all of them. But I can't, for the life of me, remember who she was. Addie swallows. You think it was a girl? Yeah, I do. It just had this energy. Maybe you dreamed her. Maybe, says Sam. I've never been good at remembering dreams. But you know, she trails off, staring at Addie the way she did that night in bed, beginning to glow. You remind me of that piece. She puts a hand over her face. God, that sounds like the worst pickup line in the world. I'm sorry. I'm going to take a shower. I should get going, says Addie. Thanks for the coffee. Sam bites her lip. Do you have to? No, she doesn't. Addie knows she could follow Sam right into the shower, wrap herself in a towel, and sit on the living room floor and see what kind of painting Sam would make of her today. She could. She could. She could fall into this moment forever, but she knows there is no future in it, only an infinite number of presents, and she has lived as many of those with Sam as she can bear. Sorry, she says, chest aching. But Sam only shrugs. We'll see each other again, she says with so much faith. After all, we're neighbors now. Addie manages a pale shadow of a smile. That's right. Sam walks her to the door, and with every step, Addie resists the urge to look back. Don't be a stranger, says Sam.
I won't, promises Addie as the door swings shut. She sighs, leaning back against it, listens to Sam's footsteps retreating down the cluttered hall before she forces herself up and forward and away. Outside, the marble white sky has cracked, letting through thin bands of blue. The cold has burned off, and Addie finds a cafe with sidewalk seating, busy enough that the waiter only has time to make a pass of the outside tables every 10 minutes or so. She counts the beats like a prisoner marking the pace of guards, orders a coffee. It isn't as good as Sam's, all bitter, no sweet, but it's warm enough to keep the chill at bay. She puts up the collar of her leather coat and opens the Odyssey again and tries to read. Here, Odysseus thinks he is heading home, to finally be reunited with Penelope after the horrors of war, but she has read the story enough times to know how far the journey is from done. She skims, translating from Greek to modern English. I fear the sharp frost and the soaking dew together will do me in. I'm bone weary, about to breathe my last, and a cold wind blows from a river on toward morning. The waiter ducks back outside, and she glances up from the book, watches him frown a little at the sight of the drink already ordered and delivered, the gap in his memory where a customer should be. But she looks like she belongs, and that's half the battle, really, and a moment later he turns his attention to the couple in the doorway, waiting for a seat. She returns to her book, but it's no use. She's not in the mood for old men lost at sea, for parables of lonely lives. She wants to be stolen away, wants to forget. A fantasy, or perhaps a romance. The coffee is cold now anyway, and Addie stands up, book in hand, and sets off for the last word to find something new. Paris, France, July 29th. 1716. 7. She stands in the shade of a silk merchant. Across the way, the tailor's shop bustles, the pace of business brisk even as the day wears on. Sweat drips down her neck as she unties and reties the bonnet, salvaged from a gust of wind, hoping the cloth cap will be enough to pass her off as a lady's maid, to grant her the kind of invisibility reserved for help. If he thinks her a maid, Bertin will not look too close. If he thinks her a maid, he might not notice Addie's dress, which is simple but fine, slipped from a tailor's model a week before in a similar shop across the Seine. It was a pretty thing at first, until she snagged the skirts on an errant nail and someone cast a bucket of soot too near her feet and red wine somehow got onto one of the sleeves. She wishes her clothes were as resistant to change as she appears to be, especially because she is only the one dress. There's no point in collecting a wardrobe, or anything else, when you've nowhere to put it. She will try, in later years, to gather trinkets, hide them away like a magpie with its nest, but something will always conspire to steal them back. Like the wooden bird, lost among the bodies in the cart, she cannot seem to hold on to much of anything for long. At last, the final customer steps out, a valet, one beribboned box beneath each arm, and before anyone else can beat her to the door, Addie darts across the street and steps inside the tailor's shop. It is a narrow space, a table piled high with rolls of fabric, a pair of dress forms modeling the latest fashions. The kind of gowns that take at least 4 hands to get on, and just as many to take off, all bolstered hips and ruffled sleeves and bosoms cinched too tight to breathe. These days, the fine society of Paris is wrapped like parcels, clearly not meant to be opened. A small bell on the door announces her arrival, and the tailor, Monsieur Bertin, looks up at her through brows as thick as brambles and makes a sour face. I am closing, he says curtly. Addie ducks her head, the picture of discretion. I am here on behalf of Madame Lautrec. It is a name plucked from the breeze, overheard on a handful of her walks, but it is the right answer. The tailor straightens, suddenly keen.
For the Lautrecs, anything.
He takes up a small pad, a charcoal pencil, and Addie's own fingers twitch, a moment of grief, a longing to draw as she so often did.
It is strange, though, he is saying, shaking the stiffness from his hands, that she would send a lady's maid in place of her valet.
He's ill,
Addie answers swiftly. She is learning to lie, to bend with the current of the conversation, follow its course.
So she sent her lady's maid instead. Madame wishes to throw a dance and is in need of a new dress. But of course, he says. You have her measurements?
I do.
He stares, waiting for her to produce a slip of paper.
No, she explains. I have her measurements. They are the same as mine. That's why she sent me.
She thinks it is a rather clever lie, but the tailor only frowns and turns toward a curtain at the back of the shop.
I will get my tape.
She catches a brief glimpse of the room beyond, a dozen dress forms, a mountain of silks, before the curtain falls again. But as Bertin slips away, so does she, vanishing between the dress forms and the rolls of muslin and cotton propped against the wall. It is not her first visit to the shop, and she has learned well its crevices and crooks, all the corners large enough to hide in. Addie folds in to one such space, and by the time Bertin returns to the front of the shop, the tape in one hand, he has forgotten all about Madame Lautrec and her peculiar maid. It is stuffy among the rolls of cloth, and she's grateful when she hears the rattle of the bell, the shuffling sound of Bertin closing up his shop. He will go upstairs to the room he keeps above, will have some soup and soak his aching hands, and go to bed before it is full night. She waits, letting the quiet settle around her, waits until she can hear the groan of his steps overhead. And then she is free to wander and peruse. A weak gray light seeps through the front window as she crosses the shop, pulls aside the heavy curtain, and steps through. The fading light slides in through a single window, just enough to see by. Along the back wall, there are cloaks, half finished, and she makes a mental note to return when summer gives way to fall and the cold sweeps through. But her focus falls on the center of the room, where a dozen dress forms stand like dancers taking up their marks, their narrow waists wrapped in shades of green and gray, a navy gown piped white, another pale blue with yellow trim. Addie smiles and casts the bonnet off onto a table, shaking loose her hair. She runs her hand over skeins of patterned silk and richly dyed cotton, savoring the textures of linen and twill, touches the boning of the corsets, the bustles at the hips, imagining herself in each. She passes the muslin and wool, simple and sturdy, lingers instead on worsted pleats and layered satin, finer than anything she saw back home. Home. It is a hard word to let go of, even now, when there is nothing left to bind her to it. She plucks at the stays of a bodice, the blue of summer, and stops, breath held, when she catches movement out of the corner of her eye. But it is only a mirror, leaning against the wall. She turns, studies herself in the silvered surface as if she were a portrait of someone else, though the truth is, she looks entirely herself. These last 2 years have felt like 10, and yet they do not show. She should have long been whittled down to skin and bone, hardened, hewn, but her face is just as full as it was the summer she left home. Her skin, unlined by time and trial, untouched in any way save for the familiar freckles on the smooth palate of her cheeks. Only her eyes mark the change, an edge of shadow threaded through the brown and gold. Addie blinks, forces her gaze away from herself and the dresses. Across the room, a trio of dark shapes, men's forms in trousers and waistcoats and jackets. In the low light, their headless forms seem alive, leaning into one another as they study her. She considers the cut of their clothes, the absence of bone stays or bustled skirts, and thinks, not for the first time, and certainly not for the last, how much simpler it would be to be a man.
how easily they move through the world and at such little cost. And then she is reaching for the nearest form, sliding off its coat, unfastening the buttons down its front. There is a strange intimacy to the undressing, and she enjoys it all the more for the fact that the man beneath her fingers is not real, and therefore cannot grope or paw or push. She frees herself from the laces of her own dress and finds her way into the trousers, fastening them below her knee. She pulls on the tunic and buttons the waistcoat, shrugs the striped coat over her shoulders, fastens the lace cravat at her throat. She feels safe in the armor of their fashion, but when she turns to the mirror, her spirits sink. Her chest is too full, her waist too narrow, her hips flaring to fill the trousers in the wrong place. The jacket helps a little, but nothing can disguise her face. The bow of her lips, the line of her cheek, the smoothness of her brow, all too soft and round to pass for anything but female. She takes up a pair of shears, tries to trim the loose coil of her hair to her shoulders, but seconds later, it is back, the locks on the floor swept away by some invisible hand. No mark made, even on herself. She finds a pin and fastens the light brown waves back in the style she has seen men wear, plucks a tricorn hat from one of the forms, and rests it above her brow. At a distance, perhaps, at a passing glance, perhaps, at night, perhaps, when the darkness is thick enough to smudge the details, but even by lamplight, the illusion does not hold. The men in Paris are soft, even pretty, but they are still men. She sighs and casts off the disguise and passes the next hour trying on dress after dress, already longing for the freedom of those trousers, the stayless comfort of that tunic. But the dresses are fine and lush. Her favorite among them is a lovely green and white, but it isn't finished yet. The collar and hem lie open, waiting for lace. She'll have to check back in a week or two, hope that she catches the dress before it's gone, wrapped in paper and sent on to the home of some baroness. In the end, Addie chooses a dark sapphire dress, its edges trimmed in gray. It reminds her of a storm at night, the clouds blotting out the sky. The silk kisses her skin, the fabric crisp and new and utterly unblemished. It is too fine for her needs, a dress for banquets, for balls, but she does not care. And if it draws strange looks, what of it? They will forget her before they have the chance to gossip. Addie leaves her own dress draped around the naked form, does not bother with the bonnet, lifted from a line of clothes that morning. She slips back through the curtain and across the shop, skirts rustling around her, finds the spare key Bertin keeps in the table's top drawer, and unlocks the door, careful to still the bell with her fingers. She pulls the door shut behind her, crouching to slip the iron key back through the gap beneath the door, then rises and turns, only to collide with a man standing on the street. It is no wonder she didn't see him. Dressed in black from his shoes to his collar, he blends right into the dark. She is already murmuring apologies, already backing away, when her gaze lifts and she sees the line of his jaw, the raven curls, the eyes, so green despite the lack of light. He smiles down at her.
Adeline.
That name, it strikes like flint on his tongue, sparks an answering light behind her ribs. His gaze drifts over her new dress.
You're looking well.
I look the same.
The prize of immortality, as you wanted.
This time she does not rise to take the bait, does not scream or swear or point out all the ways he's damned her, but he must see the struggle on her face because he laughs, soft and airy as a breeze.
Come,
says the shadow, offering his arm.
I will walk you.
He does not say that he will walk her home, and if it were midday, she would scorn the offer just to spite him. Of course, if it were midday, the darkness would not be there. But it is late, and only one kind of woman walks alone at night. Addie has learned that women, at least women of a certain class, never venture forth alone, even during the day. They are kept inside, like potted plants, tucked behind the curtains of their homes. And when they do go out, they go in groups, safe within the cages of each other's company, and always in the light of day. To walk alone in the morning is a scandal, but to walk alone at night, that is something else. Addie knows. She has felt their looks, their judgment from every side. The women scorn her from their windows, the men try to buy her on the streets, and the devout, they try to save her soul, as if she hasn't already sold it. She has said yes to the church on more than one occasion, but only for the shelter and never the salvation. "Well?" asks the shadow, holding out his arm. Perhaps she is lonelier than she would say. Perhaps an enemy's company is still better than none. Addie does not take his arm, but she does start walking, and she does not need to look to know that he has fallen in step beside her. His shoes echo softly on the cobblestones, and a faint breeze presses like a palm against her back. They walk in silence until she cannot bear it, until her resolve slips and she looks over and sees him, head tipped slightly back, dark lashes brushing fair cheeks as he breathes in the night, fetid though it is. A faint smile on those lips, as if he's perfectly at ease. His very image mocks her, even as his edges blur, dark into dark, smoke on shadow, a reminder of what he is and what he isn't. Her silence cracks. The words spill out.
"You can take any shape you please, isn't that right?"
His head tips down.
"It is."
"Then change," she says. "I cannot bear to look at you."
A rueful smile.
"I rather like this form. I think you do as well."
"I did once," she says. "But you have ruined it for me."
It is an opening she sees too late, a crack in her own armor. Now he will never change. Addie stops on a narrow, winding street before a house, if it can be called that, a slumping wooden structure, like a pile of kindling, deserted, abandoned, but not empty. When he is gone, she will climb through the gap in the boards, trying not to ruin the hem of her new skirts, will cross the uneven floor and go up a set of broken stairs to the attic and hope that no one else has found it first. She will climb out of her storm cloud dress and fold it carefully within a piece of tissue paper, and then she will lie down on a pallet of burlap and board and stare up through the split planks of the ceiling 2 feet over her head and hope it does not rain while the lost souls creep through the body of the house below. Tomorrow, the little room will be taken. And in a month, the building will burn down, but there is no sense worrying about the future now. The darkness shifts like a curtain at her back.
"How long will you carry on?" he muses. "What is the point of dragging yourself through another day when there is no reprieve?"
Questions she has asked herself in the dead of night, moments of weakness when winter sank its teeth into her skin or hunger clawed against her bones, when a space was taken, a day's work undone, a night's peace lost, and she could not bear the thought of rising to do it all again. And yet, hearing the words parroted back like this in his voice instead of hers, they lose a measure of their venom.
"Don't you see?" he says, green eyes sharp as broken glass. "There is no end besides the one I offer. All you have to do is yield."
"I saw an elephant," says Addie, and the words are like cold water on coals.
The darkness stills beside her, and she continues, gaze fixed on the ramshackle house and the broken roof and the open sky above.
"Two, in fact. They were in the palace grounds, as part of some display. I didn't know animals could be so large. And there was a fiddler in the square the other day,"
she presses on, her voice steady.
"And his music made me cry. It was the prettiest song I'd ever heard. I had champagne,
drank it straight from the bottle and watched the sun set over the Seine while the bells rang out from Notre Dame, and none of it would have happened back in Villon.
She turns to look at him.
It has only been 2 years, she says. Think of all the time I have and all the things I'll see.
Addie grins at the shadow then, a small, feral smile, all teeth, feasting on the way the humor falls from his face. It is a small victory, and yet so sweet to see him falter, even for an instant. And then suddenly he is too close, the air between them snuffed like a candle. He smells of summer nights, of earth and moss and tall grass waving beneath stars, and of something darker, of blood on rocks and wolves loose in the woods. He leans in until his cheek brushes against hers, and when he speaks again, the words are little more than whispers over skin.
You think it will get easier, he says. It will not. You are as good as gone, and every year you live will feel a lifetime, and in every lifetime you will be forgotten. Your pain is meaningless. Your life is meaningless. The years will be like weights around your ankles. They will crush you bit by bit, and when you cannot stand it, you will beg me to put you from your misery.
Addie pulls back to face the darkness, but he is already gone. She stands alone on the narrow road, inhales a low, unsteady breath, forces it out again, and then straightens and smooths her skirts and makes her way into the broken house that, tonight at least, is home.